Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Foreign Cubed Case Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 24th, 2010, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Morrison v. National Australia Bank. The question in this case was whether Section 10B of the Securities and Exchange Act of 1934 and SEC Rule 10B-5, both of which are anti-fraud provisions, applied to allegations that fraudulent activity in the United States affected the sale price of an Australian bank's stock in Australia. In an opinion delivered by Justice Scalia, the court held that Section 10B and Rule 10B-5 did not give rise to a cause of action for this conduct. The court reasoned that Section 10B and Rule 10B-5 did not apply extraterritorially in light of the long-standing presumption that legislation, absent clear contrary indication, will be held to apply only within the territorial jurisdiction of the United States, and that the conduct alleged to have taken place in the United States was not sufficient to trigger application of the statute, given its focus on the purchase and sale of securities in the United States. To discuss the case, we have Hofstra University School of Law Associate Professor Ronald J. Colombo. Professor Colombo joined a brief in support of the respondent. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Colombo.
Hello, my name is Ron Colombo, and I'm an Associate Professor of Law at Hofstra University School of Law. In this podcast, I'll be examining the case of Morrison v. National Australia Bank, which the U.S. Supreme Court decided on June 24, 2010. Morrison is an example of an F-cubed or foreign-cubed case, meaning a securities fraud case involving a foreign plaintiff suing a foreign company with regard to shares of that company purchased on a foreign securities exchange. And the issue presented by such cases is whether or not Rule 10b-5, the general anti-fraud provision contained in the 1934 Securities Exchange Act, can be applied to them. In other words, can a plaintiff bring a lawsuit in a United States court alleging violation of Rule 10b-5 on account of securities fraud if the plaintiff is foreign to the U.S., if the defendant is foreign to the U.S., and if the securities were purchased on a market foreign to the U.S.? The question has troubled the federal judiciary for quite some time and has now finally been resolved by the U.S. Supreme Court. The primary defendant in Morrison was National Australia Bank, or NAB. NAB bills itself as Australia's largest bank and holds hundreds of billions of dollars in assets. It has issued approximately 1.5 billion ordinary shares of stock. And yes, I said ordinary. That's the Australian equivalent to American common stock. And these shares trade on the Australian, London, Tokyo, and New Zealand stock exchanges, not on any exchange in the United States. Now, it should be noted that National American Depository Receipts, ADRs, for NAB ordinary stock are indeed listed on the New York Stock Exchange. These ADRs are not NAB stock, but rather can be exchanged for NAB stock. Although interesting, this fact is not particularly relevant because none of the plaintiffs remaining in the case, as it was presented to the Second Circuit below and to the Supreme Court, purchased these ADRs. Instead, the remaining plaintiffs in the case had all purchased the actual NAB shares on foreign non-U.S. exchanges. Now, one of NAB's subsidiaries since 1998 is Homeside Lending, Inc., an American mortgage servicing company headquartered in Jacksonville, Florida. Since its acquisition by NAB in 1998, Homeside's profits were included in NAB's net profit totals. And these profits were fairly substantial, amounting to $153 million in 1999, $141 million in 2000, or 4.5% and 4.1% of NAB's total profits, respectively, for those 2 years. Or so everyone thought, for it turns out that Homeside had been engaging in certain questionable accounting practices. More specifically, Homeside had been overestimating the value of its mortgage servicing business by using incorrect assumptions in its valuation model. This made its profit numbers inaccurate. As a result, NAB announced in July 2001 that it was going to take a $450 million write-down due to a recalculation of Homeside's profitability. NAB's stock fell by more than 5% in response to this announcement. Another write-down was announced in September 2001, this time to the tune of $1.75 billion, and this write-down triggered a 13% drop in the value of NAB's stock. None of this was particularly pleasing to holders of the NAB stock, who brought suit against NAB and against Homeside and several allegedly responsible individuals, claiming securities fraud. What makes their suit so particularly interesting is where and under what law they decided to file suit. In the Southern District of New York, asserting a violation of Rule 10b-5 of the 1934 Securities Exchange Act, which is a component of American, not Australian, securities law. In response to this lawsuit, NAB filed a motion to dismiss on a couple of grounds. One, lack of subject matter jurisdiction, and two, failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. The motion to dismiss was granted by the district court on the ground that subject matter jurisdiction was lacking, and the Second Circuit affirmed. According to the Second Circuit, where the subject matter jurisdiction exists turns on the jurisdictional reach of U.S. securities law in general, and the anti-fraud rule, 10b-5, in particular. Rule 10b-5 prohibits fraud in connection with the purchase or sale of a security. Its promulgation by the SEC was authorized by Section 10b of the 1934 Securities Exchange Act, the underlying purpose of which was to remedy deceptive and manipulative conduct with the potential to harm the public interest or the interests of investors. The critical question that the Second Circuit had to contend with in Morrison was whether Section 10b and Rule 10b-5 reaches transactions that take place outside of the United States, transactions by foreign investors in foreign companies on foreign markets. The text of Section 10b and of Rule 10b-5 is completely silent on that important subject. In the face of this silence, the Second Circuit held that Section 10b and Rule 10b-5 can indeed reach certain transactions that take place outside of the United States. Whether these provisions reach such transactions depends upon the conduct test and the effects test. The conduct test looks into whether the wrongful conduct occurred in the United States. The effects test looks into whether the wrongful conduct had a substantial effect in the United States or upon U.S. citizens. If both tests are passed, that is, if the wrongful conduct occurs in the U.S. and the effects of the conduct are felt in the U.S., then subject matter jurisdiction would most likely exist under Section 10b and Rule 10b-5. If neither test is passed, then U.S. subject matter jurisdiction is highly unlikely. But if just one test is passed, if you have conduct or you have effects, the possibility of finding subject matter jurisdiction still persists. It would just require deeper factual inquiry. Since this was an F-cubed case, plaintiffs were not asserting that the fraud had any effect in the United States. Plaintiffs had put all of their eggs in the conduct test basket and were arguing for the exercise of U.S. jurisdiction on the basis of the conduct test alone. Now, in discussing the conduct test, the Second Circuit said that it was important to distinguish between conduct that was merely preparatory versus conduct that directly caused harm to the investors. The former conduct, merely preparatory conduct, could not justify the exercise of U.S. jurisdiction. Only the latter conduct could. In applying the conduct test, the Second Circuit held that the fraudulent conduct occurring in Florida, that is, Homeside's improper accounting methodology, was merely preparatory, and thus subject matter jurisdiction was lacking. According to the court, Homeside's misconduct was merely preparatory because it did not directly harm investors. Investors were harmed by NAB's decision to incorporate Homeside's financials into its own and to publish these financials to the public. And all that occurred in Australia. Now, obviously, this was a disappointment to the plaintiffs, who successfully obtained certiorari to the U.S. Supreme Court. But the decision was also a disappointment to several amici who weighed in on the defendant's behalf. For as becomes quite clear, the Second Circuit does not categorically deny subject matter jurisdiction over F-cubed cases. Instead, the Second Circuit said that such cases must be put through the conduct test or the effects test, and whether or not jurisdiction exists depends upon how these tests turn out. Now, several amici had petitioned the Second Circuit and renewed their petition to the Supreme Court to adopt a bright-line rule proclaiming that Section 10b and Rule 10b-5 simply do not extend to F-cubed cases, period, in the interest of full disclosure, I personally signed on to one of these amicus briefs. The rationales for this bright-line rule are manifold. One, when statutes are silent as to their extraterritorial application, it is a matter of general statutory interpretation to apply them only domestically. Thus, Section 10b's silence as to its extraterritorial application should be interpreted as limiting its application to fraud affecting U.S. investors and U.S. securities markets. Two, the legislative history of the 1934 Securities Act demonstrates that Congress was well aware of foreign securities markets and intentionally excluded them from the reach of Section 10b. Three, as a matter of public policy, U.S. courts are busy enough dealing with domestic securities fraud and it's a poor use of our limited judicial resources to open up our courts to foreign investors who purchase stock in foreign companies on foreign exchanges. Four, as a matter of public policy, again, a bright-line rule is far easier to administer and as a result more predictable than the conduct and effects test employed by the Second Circuit. And finally, there are important substantive and procedural differences between U.S. securities law and the securities law of other nations. Applying U.S. securities fraud law to F-cubed transactions is a form of legal imperialism of sorts, under which the United States imposes its rules upon foreign investors suing foreign firms for fraud on foreign markets. Now, as I mentioned, the Second Circuit chose not to adopt a bright-line rule. The Second Circuit downplayed the potential conflict between the U.S. and non-U.S. securities laws, basically saying that when it comes to fraud, we're all against it. Moreover, and perhaps more persuasively, the Second Circuit decried the exportation of fraud from America. The circuit was uncomfortable with a rule that would protect a fraudster from being sued in the United States, quote, just because they carry a foreign passport or victimize foreign shareholders. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously upheld the Second Circuit's affirmance of the district court's dismissal in Morrison. The decision was 8-0, with the newly appointed Justice Sotomayor not participating. But on the grounds for upholding the dismissal, the court split 5-3. The majority opinion was authored by Justice Scalia and joined by Justices Kennedy, Thomas Alito, and Chief Justice Roberts. This opinion adopted the bright-line rule that was urged by several of the amici. It rejected the Second Circuit's conduct and effects test and held that, quote, Section 10b reaches the use of a manipulative or deceptive device or contrivance only in connection with the purchase or sale of a security listed on an American stock exchange and the purchase or sale of any other security in the United States. In reaching this holding, the court did so for three of the five rationales I previously identified. One, when statutes such as 10b are silent as to the extraterritorial application, it is a matter of general statutory interpretation to apply them only domestically. Two, a bright-line rule is easier to administer and more predictable than the conduct and effects tests of the Second Circuit. And three, given the important substantive and procedural differences between U.S. securities law and the securities law of other nations, application of U.S. securities law to F-cube transactions would amount to an unwelcomed American interference in such matters. Justice Breyer wrote a very short concurrence in which he stated that since Morrison only implicated the purchase or sale of a security not registered with the SEC on a national securities exchange, he would limit its holding accordingly. In other words, he would leave for another day the question of whether Section 10b would apply in other circumstances, such as if the security in question had been listed on a foreign national securities exchange that had itself registered with the SEC. Justice Breyer wanted to keep that door open and unresolved. Now, Justice Stevens wrote a lengthier concurrence in which Justice Ginsburg joined. In it, Justice Stevens argues in favor of affirming the dismissal on the same grounds as did the Second Circuit, via application of the conduct and effects test. Justice Stevens based his argument largely on the fact that, according to him, the Second Circuit's approach in this area had become a North Star, those are his words, for nearly four decades, and he did not want to unsettle it. Now, before closing, allow me to drop two footnotes on the Morrison case. The first is that Justice Scalia begins the opinion with a civil procedure lesson in which he explains the difference between dismissing a case under Rule 12b-1 for lack of subject matter jurisdiction versus Rule 12b-6 for the failure to state a claim upon which relief could be granted. Subject matter jurisdiction goes to a tribunal's power to hear a case, and as such presents an issue quite separate from whether or not the plaintiff's allegations entitle him or her to relief. Now, in Morrison, the courts had, the district court and the Second Circuit had dismissed the case or affirmed the dismissal on grounds that subject matter jurisdiction was lacking. Justice Scalia said that's erroneous. The court should have properly dismissed the case under Rule 12b-6 for failing to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. The second footnote has to do with something on page 1330 of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. As of this date, which is being recorded on July 9, 2010, the act has cleared the House and Senate Conference Committee and awaits a full vote in each chamber. Now, on this page, page 1330 of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, there's some language that would undo a portion of Morrison by vesting the SEC and the DOJ authority to prosecute securities fraud cases involving, quote, one, conduct within the United States that constitutes significant steps in furtherance of the violation, even if the securities transaction occurs outside the United States and involves only foreign investors, or two, conduct occurring outside the United States that has a foreseeable substantial effect within the United States. Thus, if this bill becomes a law and this provision remains intact, Morrison's holding would be limited to private rights of action. The SEC and the DOJ would continue to operate under the more flexible conduct and effects tests of the Second Circuit. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.